Hello, and welcome to the Tuesday, October 4, 2022 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer, dead and gone, to discuss their music and or their recordings. Now, with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is Indianapolis-based roots rock pop singer-songwriter Brett Wiskons. Sometimes the most difficult circumstances offer a silver lining. One has to look for it, but it's there, ready to be discovered. Brett Wiskons felt that reality all too keenly when the pandemic made for unique and trying times to put together his album, Late Bloomer, and the silver lining mentality ended up permeating the songs on the record. I just wanted to offer hope in a seemingly hopeless situation, Wiskons says of the genesis for the album. These songs wouldn't have existed without the kindness of my Kickstarter backers, and I wouldn't have written some of them if it hadn't been for the global pandemic. His new full-length album, Late Bloomer, was a labor of love created with mix engineer, producer, and collaborator Tom Daugherty, also of The Elms and the band Perry, and was released on July 13, 2022 via Wiskons' own label, MAD, Diamond Entertainment. Wiskons released the title cut from his album as a single in February 2020. I am a late bloomer, and I figured many other folks out there might be able to relate to this song. Late Bloomer, mere weeks before everything shut down, but the track garnered Wiskons' new fans from as far afield as Australia, Morocco, and the United Kingdom, to name a few places where other late bloomers chimed in to let Wiskons know how much his song resonated with them. In July of 2020, Late Bloomer appeared on the soundtrack for the new NASCAR Heat 5 video game on Xbox and PlayStation. With the song out in the world, Wiskons and Daugherty had huge aspirations to record a full album by the same name. I knew it had to be done, but I knew it was going to be expensive to produce, Wiskons says. I had success with Kickstarter before, so I ran a campaign and hoped for the best. What happened next blew Wiskons away. Somehow, 137 people scattered around the country believed in me and this project, and we raised over $22,000 and were completely funded 2 weeks into the 30-day campaign. Wiskons and Daugherty had planned to get to work in mid-March of 2020, but the pandemic had a little to say first. By May 2020, they started working remotely, writing lyric and song ideas and passing them back and forth via text and email while communicating through the Marco Polo app. News topics and emotional responses laced other tracks. You really hear all of the influences Tom and I grew up with come out in these songs, Wiscon says. There are shades of the Beatles, Pearl Jam, Eagles, Jackson Browne, and Hootie and the Blowfish all over the songs on the album, but with Wiscon's unique spin on things, making it feel fresh and new. Born in Chicago, Wiscon's and his family moved to the state of Indiana in the early 1980s. I thank my dad and mom for exposing me to the music of the Beach Boys, Eagles, and Sade in those early days, Wiscon says with a smile. It helped shape me into the musician I am today. His music career officially started when he teamed up with some high school buddies to form his first band, The Owls, in 1996. He started writing his own music and lyrics, and then he fell in love with entertaining and being a frontman. More bands began and ended in high school and at Marion University, Indianapolis. Wiscon's is especially proud of the time spent with his band, Great Scott, during their prime years of 2002 to 2008, when they toured throughout the Midwest and released original music. He always had a day job, with music relegated to being his weekend fun. But Wiscon's continued to have aspirations to make music his full-time profession. On May 1st, 2008, Wiscon's kissed corporate America goodbye and began his endeavor to perform and write music while hopefully keeping the lights on and paying rent on time. He joined up with his friend John Shoulders, and they became the Michaels. Both Wiscon's and Shoulders have the same middle name. Two original extended plays were released by the duo, and shows were booked and performed in the Midwest and East Coast. After 5 years of relentless gigging, the pair decided to call it a career. Wiscon's had a choice to make, go solo or go back to a 9-to-5. There really wasn't a choice. One of the first things he did was reach out to Mark Bryan from his all-time favorite band, Hootie and the Blowfish. I asked him if he'd produce my debut solo record. He kindly accepted. What followed were writing sessions in Awandaw and Charleston, South Carolina. Mark gave me a masterclass in how to write a hook, he recalls. Mark also explained that sometimes the most direct way of writing lyrics is, in fact, the best way. Wiscon's released the Heineken Sessions Deluxe in 2016 via Captain Beardo Records, which garnered him some national airplay for the songs Don't Be the One and Star Azona. I still play a lot of those songs today that Mark and I wrote, Wiscon says. Those sessions were a lot of fun, and I'm grateful to Mark for taking me under his wing and propelling my solo career for a long stretch of time. Mark was even kind enough to lay down a mandolin track on the new album. Wiscon's has always been a bit of a road warrior, and while on tour, he has had the honor of sharing the stage with a vast array of international and touring acts, including John Bon Jovi, Jimmy Buffett, Darius Rucker, the Zac Brown Band, Katy Perry, Collective Soul, Leanne Rimes, Tesla, Rick Springfield, 311, Tonic, Lifehouse, The Bodines, Trace Atkins, Hootie and the Blowfish, Sister Hazel, and Will Hoge, among others. In April 2019, he was hand-selected to perform on the John Bon Jovi Runaway to Paradise Caribbean Cruise. His performances have occurred in 26 states on hundreds of stages, equaling over 3,000 gigs. The music he has written and recorded has appeared on Australian television, AAA radio, and the international smash hit Tony Kornheiser Show. An everyday mediator and learner, Wisconsin's entered his 42nd year with high hopes to deliver a batch of songs and live performances that will deeply connect with his fans and continue to breed his thirst for life. With Late Bloomer, he is poised to share his own silver lining with listeners around the globe. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Brett Wisconsin.
Hello, Brett. It's really great to talk to you.
Hello, Craig. It's great to talk to you too, sir.
Very glad to have you as a guest on my my podcast today. I'd like to get right to your new album, which was released July 13th, your album Late Bloomer. One of the general questions I like to ask singer-songwriters, well, artists in general, is, you know, the ancient Greeks and Romans used to say that the purpose of tragedy and their drama was to serve as an emotional cleansing, a catharsis, if you will, for those who were witnessing the drama. Do you feel that the songs you write are done with the idea of providing an emotional catharsis for yourself as a reflection of personal experiences, or are they songs constructed to elicit a catharsis for others? Or are you merely making commentary in what you observe occurring in society and life?
That's a really good question all around. Very, very deep and introspective. And I would say it might be a combination of all of the above, to be quite honest. But it starts at home, you know, with me and things I'm going through or have gone through and trying to process those things, those events, to try to understand them better. So yeah, writing has always been a form of catharsis for me, without a doubt. And the hope is people can relate in some way, you know, maybe not identically to me and what I've gone through, but in a way they might have gone through something very similar, or and they didn't know how to find the words to process it. And maybe some of these songs, and I already know some of them are helping people. I've already heard from people. So, okay. I guess it's working. That, you know, I don't do it without, I do it on purpose, but I don't do it disingenuously. As I assume you understand and other people would understand. It's really the, I try to be as forthright and open and vulnerable as I can, especially through my art. I'm still working on that in my real life, but the art kind of is a channel for me to tap into that vulnerability that I can't really always tap into in a one-on-one conversation with a real person, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I mean, as a musician myself, there's a lot of things that we can't express musically that words are inadequate to describe, and so I think that that's a valid point. And two, I mean, you know, human beings, we all have maybe not exactly the same kinds of experiences, but we have enough similar experiences, I think, where there's some common denominator of relating to what's being expressed. Well, then what I'm curious to know is for you to tell my audience who or what is typically your muse. Who or what inspires you to write a new song?
I just had this conversation the other day with a girl, and a girl that I really liked, but it didn't work out. I guess I had the conversation with her. Yeah, I guess we did have it through like text. And then I wrote her a letter as well to kind of reiterate that point. Just to say, you know, the muse showed up in a lot of different ways on this album. Somebody's coming down my driveway, but anyway, it's all good.
Okay.
There's the muse coming right to my front door as we
there
speak.
There you go. You never know.
And it comes in different ways. It comes through human beings. They may not even realize that they are the deliverer of, you know, the news. Actually, there's probably no way they realize that, actually. You know, it could be a stranger I meet for 5 minutes on the bus or subway or plane, grocery store, not even have a conversation with them sometimes, just see them. I'm a very visual person. I have a pretty good memory. I don't know how I say it, but yeah, I was just gifted a good memory. And so I go back in time. Maybe I misremember things, possibly, but I do pull back from memories from my past. I do just stay open to people in person, what they're going through, what they kind of just volunteer to you. It's kind of amazing what people will volunteer to you, that even in a very brief moment of meeting, of never meeting again, you know. It's little things like that. You know, of course, friends that are going through things. I listen. I take some of the things they say and turn them into songs.
Yeah.
I also write books. So I've just finished my fifth novel, and I really explore the human condition in those books. Especially my own human condition. And I don't know, you know, ex-girlfriends.
Well, I can relate. I'm not a songwriter, and I don't necessarily find inspiration from this activity, but I like to go to public places and I like to watch people.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when I'm watching people and I see someone, and either by the manner in which they're walking or the way they're carrying themselves or the way they look, very often the question will come to my mind, gee, I wonder what their story is. What's their background? And of course, what comes to mind more than likely is probably fiction, but it might be based in some sort of reality. And I think that, you know, we can witness and see a lot of, you know, situations and kind of build, you know, what the heck is that all about? What's going on here? And creatively, you know, build a story that may or may not necessarily be a true story, but it's still a good story.
For sure.
You know, I think that sort of thing can certainly go on. I once asked a playwright about, you know, his creative, his muse, and he talked about how that he had collections of just various kinds of relationships. And that's how he would start with when he would write a play, is that he would consider some of them were bizarre. But nonetheless, they were, you know, gee, what about the relationship between, you know, a person and an animal, or a person and, you know, some other, you know, inanimate object or something, you know, and he would have these different ideas as inspiration for his plays. I suppose the same sort of thing can be true of a song. If you think of a song as kind of a nice little, you know, story that's kind of told in, you know, 3 to 4, maybe 5 minutes, depending on how long you're telling your story. Well, Brett, I'm really curious to know who were models for your singing style. I've been listening to your recordings, and I'd be curious to know.
I would say the first one that comes to mind is Darius Rucker.
Okay.
From Hootie and the Blowfish. That band in general really shaped me into the writer and the singer I am. I mean, nobody can sing like Darius, but he had a lot of emotion in his voice and power. And I tried to mean, I just started singing along to
sure
their stuff when they came out in the early mid 90s. So definitely that with the, if you hear some of my stuff, it's got a little more rock and grit to it. I would say it's kind of the Darius Rucker side, early Hootie stuff. And also probably Eddie Vedder was a big influence of mine vocally. Jim Morrison was a big influence of mine, and Glenn Frey.
Okay.
I would say those four were probably my, did I say four? Three or four, whoever I said. Yeah, four. Yeah, those four were probably my my main influences. But since then, you know, I've softened up a little bit. And I really like Dean Martin and Michael Bublé and Frank Sinatra and those cats as well.
Sure. More of the crooner style.
Yeah, Billy Joel is a big big influence now. And I'm trying to put together a Billy Joel tribute show maybe for 2023.
Oh, okay.
Which I think would be a lot of fun. And I am going to do an Eagles song later this year, a cover version of one of their songs.
Uh-huh.
And release that.
Sure.
Because the Eagles are just a huge influence of mine for the last 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and it's time.
They were a great band.
They were. I just saw them in March, actually.
Uh-huh.
And they sounded incredible.
Oh, that's great. Great. Well, on the singer-songwriter side of things, who are some songwriters that you admire and perhaps have modeled yourself after?
Hootie and the Blowfish, that whole band, everything they've done. Edwin McCain. Edwin McCain out of South Carolina as well. I should also say he was one of my vocal influences. But his songwriting is really incredible. He writes from a very honest place. And also, let's see, who else? Eagle, you know, the Eagles too. You know, I what draws me in is the vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And then what keeps me there is the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why people like Glenn Frey and the Hootie guys and Edwin McCain, that's why they've been so instrumental to me.
Sure.
Because not only can they sing really well, they can craft a good song and a good story and
right
deliver it in a very honest way. And that's all I'm trying to do. That's really all I'm trying to do from here on out.
Sure. Sure. Well, there is something. There is something that draws us in. I vocal harmonies. You know, there's some styles of, you know, rock and pop music. We don't hear that, and that's okay. But I have to agree. I enjoy, you know, those bands that. I mean, even going all the way back to say the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
What was attractive about them was the vocal harmonies and kind of the jazz harmonizations they used in their vocals. You could even kind of come forward and, you know, with the Beatles and the two-voiced, you know, vocal harmony of Lennon and McCartney sort of coming on the heels of the Everly Brothers, you know, which is was their style. I was a big fan of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, for that very same reason, loved those vocal harmonies.
Totally.
And as I've kind of moved forward, you know, I think sometimes my favorite groups to listen to today are jazz vocal groups. I love jazz harmonies, and I love the very kind of tight voicing and harmonic structure that often you get in those kind of groups. So I understand where you're coming from, because certainly people that you've named and that vocal harmony aspect is something that is very attractive in an overall sound.
Totally love the Beach Boys. Love the Beach Boys too.
And Billy Joel, you know, he's an interesting character. I have been finding out more and more about him in terms of his music writing. He is not only writes a lot of popular songs, but he also writes music in the classical arena.
Yeah.
I came across that totally by happenstance when I was listening to music on the Sirius XM radio, the classical station. And they said, yeah, we're going to now feature a piece by Billy Joel. And I thought, wow, what's this going to be like? Mm. You know, so it's a totally shift, a total different side of his musical personality. But it's there, and it's rather kind of interesting.
That is cool.
That
was a newer recording?
Well, as I recall, you know, because I have to imagine that he's probably, you know, slowed down some with his solo act and solo touring, just simply because of, you know, he's getting older. And so he's maybe also finding time to venture into other aspects of his creative mind and doing some of these things. So it's interesting to me to find out about that side of him, which I had, you know, no idea of. I mean, I was always just hooked on his lyrics and stories that he would tell. I mean, I can still remember the very first time I ever heard Piano Man.
Yeah.
You know, 30, 40 years ago, maybe.
Probably 40. Yeah. This at least.
And I know probably it was when four. It was probably when I was in college. So maybe even more. Yeah. 50 years ago. Anyway, however long ago, and still just being really totally sucked in with the whole mental picture and the storyline that he was creating in that song. I thought that was really great. But let's get back to you. One of the things, this is supposed to be all about you.
It's all good. I'm here for it.
Well, that's all right. You know, because these other people, they're with us and they, you know, they shape how we look and think at things.
Absolutely.
But what I'm interested in specific to you is your creative process. When you write a new song, do you typically start with a melodic idea, a rhythmic idea, a particular set of chords, or do you start with a lyric, a particular mood or emotion?
Lately, since I started working on this album, over like 2.5 years ago, when we started the writing process with my producer, Tom, since I started that process and into the present day, it's been basically starting with lyrics.
Okay.
For me. Yeah. You know, I wrote this whole album with my producer, Tom Doherty. He, pun intended, was very instrumental in making this happen.
Sure.
We are a, really good writing duo, and the way it works for us is I write the lyrics and he writes the music.
Okay.
And the melodies.
Okay.
And now I've written melodies on my last album, and even a song I did with Tom right before we did the album, I wrote the whole thing. But it really opened my eyes when I worked with him in this capacity. And he's a musical, I use this term, I don't use it flippantly you know, in jest. Like, he is actually a musical genius.
Mm-hmm.
I can write lyrics all day, and I can sing, but he can compose and he can mix and match the emotion to the words I give him. Mm-hmm. I would just send him 6 lines and say, you know, I'm thinking there's no musical connection yet. Like, here's these lines to the song, whatever, Deja Vu from the album.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the songs. Here's an idea. Here's like the first chorus, I think, maybe. But I don't know how it sounds, but here's the words. And he's like, okay, let me, you know, sit with it. And then he'll come back with like a fully formed song without lyrics yet, but he's like humming a melody.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take that melody and then I fit the words in there to make it work. And then he'll help, you know, he's like, nah, I think you need a different word here. We need this word here. We went back and forth on it like that. And it just opened my mind to like, and we never were in the same room. Uh-huh. We did this all remotely.
Sure.
And it's just like, I have to write like that. Nah, I don't have to write like that going forward, but I want to write like that more. So, long story. Yeah. These days I'm writing with a couple other people just remotely right now, just kind of keeping the muscles working, you know?
Sure.
And I'm just sending lyric ideas and maybe like a couple examples of, oh, I think this song could sound like an Adele song or an Eagle song or whoever it might be. Cause I'm writing with a couple women. So I don't necessarily even have to sing the songs we're writing. I just want to be a part of the process and
sure.
maybe write the lyrics or part of the lyrics. And it may be a female that is going to sing the song anyway. So, just trying to keep it open like that. And I'd always thought you had to sit in the same room to write songs together, but you don't. And, I can write words. I write every day, honestly, in some capacity. Now, I'm not saying I write songs every day, but I do write every day.
Sure.
And that just keeps the flow going. You know, people talk about writer's block, but I don't believe in writer's block. I think that's a made up cop out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you write bad stuff sometimes and it's not worthy of being released, but you at least for me, I mean, I can write all day, every day. But I'm not saying the stuff's going to be worth a damn, but
I understand.
But you have to write the shit to find the, you know, the gold.
Well, it's like, you know, like I used to teach a class called creativity and problem solving. One of the things that I told the class is to get a good idea, you have to generate a lot of ideas, period. Yeah. And most of them are not going to be very good. But if you get that one really great idea, then it's been worth it. But, you know, in a lot of ways, what you're telling me makes tons of sense. I mean, if you're a novelist, you're a word guy.
Yeah.
You know, and perhaps you approach what your songs like they're snippets of poetry. You know, you come up with a particular line that you think sounds good or trips off the tongue.
Yeah.
And feels good and so forth. And then have a musician like your producer then put the melody and the harmonies and so forth to it.
Right.
That's that, and the idea that you're journaling, it's interesting to me. I ask this that question of every singer songwriter that I've interviewed, and everybody has a lot of different approaches. I've had everything from someone who said they would write songs because they would be inspired by some catchphrase they would hear. And another's a jazz singer in New York that I interviewed, when she writes her own material, she starts with a title, like she's writing a theme, you know, for English class, right? And then all the words, the lyrics have to be in support of the title of what that goes with. Singer-songwriter I talked to last week in Nashville said, well, the first thing I write is the chorus and then the hook. And she, like you talk about working with, she said she really prefers to do co-writes just simply because she loves the feedback and the interaction about, you know, ideas about how to make a song, you know, go and make it grow. So that's
right.
Everybody's different. Everybody has different ways. I am curious. Now you say you write every day. So do you keep a sketchbook with lyrical ideas or things that you draw upon, or is it just your journaling? And then later you go back to that and say, hey, I might get a song out of this.
I'll tell you what, every day I write a gratitude list of what I'm grateful for that day. That's the one thing I definitely write every single day. And then I have in my phone, like that's handwritten. I have a yellow legal pad of just pages and pages of gratitude lists. And then I have other notebooks for writing lyrics, and I have other notebooks for writing my emotions and my thoughts and just catharsis in that way that may or may not turn into songs. And then I have another notebook that I just try to sort other things through. And then I don't know. I write, I have on my phone too, you know, like notes, the note feature on the iPhone. That's where I keep a lot of my song ideas, because that's an easy way to share with another person, the shared note option.
Right.
And so I've got a bunch of those going too. Yeah. I'm in love with the written word.
Yeah. Well, I've always enjoyed singer songwriters who craft words in very unique and ways, and especially ways that I find that when I listen to them, I can envision in my mind's eye the scene that they're describing.
Detail.
And it's just, I love that when I have that experience, when I'm listening to music, you know, or, of course, then too, I also like to focus on musical elements, but when it comes to songs, I'm kind of, you know, I really love that, lyrical content as well. Well, I'd like to shift gears now to focus on some of the songs from the new album that personally caught my ear. Ones that stood out to me. They may not be, you know, the biggest hits with everyone else, but these are the ones that stuck out to me and that I enjoyed the most. The first one is When You Can't Breathe.
Okay.
And certainly the song appealed to me as commentary on the response to the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And my question for you is, when you wrote the song, is the song a lament of the event, or is it through the lens of encouraging standing up for the rights of oppressed people in our society?
Both.
Okay.
But probably more so the trying to stand up for people that couldn't on their own and are oppressed every day. I don't really write that way much, that those kinds of themes, to be you know quite honest, but I was shocked, and well, I guess I can't be too shocked with the current state of affairs in America. Uh-huh. but I was definitely appalled to see that play out on, you know, television. And and my producer, Tom, he's a lot more out there with his social, and as far as like talking about it openly, his mm-hmm. social and political views. And I'm a little more keep it to myself. You know, I'll talk about it
mm-hmm.
with friends and not in a public forum per se.
Mm-hmm.
But there was really no choice in the matter. I had to do it. I had to say something,
and sure.
Tom was all on board to, you know, to try to, that song's pretty angry, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's not misdirected anger either. It's anger at mm-hmm. the system and the oppression. And we just wanted to capture that emotion. And, mm-hmm. you know, as two basically white guys trying to,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm a little more diverse in my background than I realized as of like a year or so ago when I got some DNA results, but I'm still, you know, mostly a white guy, you know,
yeah.
people see me, they mostly think I'm a white guy, but, I have asthma. So there was this is kind of not off topic. It may seem like it's coming out of left field, but when I was a kid, I had really bad asthma. And I still have asthma, but it's pretty much under control. But I had moments where I had to go to the emergency room because I couldn't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a terrifying feeling.
Sure it is.
I haven't had it, somebody with their knee on my neck, but I could tap into that emotion and that feeling of being a, you know, an 8-year-old boy
mm-hmm.
and not being able to breathe, honestly. And
yeah.
So I tried to tap into that. And then, you know, it didn't take much else to, you know, I could see what was happening on TV. So
mm-hmm.
I could tap into that pretty easily too. But that's where it came from. Yeah.
Sure.
And it's resonating. It got signed to there's a sync licensing company out in LA that signed it to an exclusive 3-year contract to pitch it to TV and film. So they heard something in it too. Sure. They wanted it badly enough to sign it exclusively, and hopefully we'll hear it on, you know, the right show or the right commercial or the right avenue to have it have some impact.
Sure. Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, good for you. That's great to hear. I also, several months ago, interviewed another singer-songwriter from Libertyville, Illinois, by the name of Ike Riley.
And oh, I know Ike Riley. I know his name. Yeah. Okay. I don't know him. I know his name for sure.
Well, Ike, of course, Libertyville's not far from, you know, across the border of Wisconsin, where I live.
Uh-huh.
And of course, we had some problems in Kenosha. Yeah. Back, you know, with riots and so forth. He wrote a song about Kenosha that was very, and the video that went with it that was, I thought, very powerful and really a nice piece of work. And it sounds like When You Can't Breathe is going to be, you know, likewise. And we'll look forward to when that does show up. Hopefully it'll be used in a very appropriate setting.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Well, the title cut for the album is A Late Bloomer, was released as a single in 2020. And I think I read somewhere in your promotion materials that it seemed to resonate with others who considered themselves to be late bloomers. I'm assuming the song is autobiographical, but do you feel that the song is more than only your story?
Oh, yeah, totally. It is autobiographical. I tried to keep that mystique going for a while, but I'm done with that.
Okay.
Now. But I, you know, I'd still name the character in the song Joey.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not completely. It is actually. It's pretty much me.
Okay.
And where I was, and where I'm going, and who I am now, and it was easy to write. Honestly, mm-hmm. I mean, I told Tom, geez, professor, I told Tom in May 2019, like, I want to write a song called Late Bloomer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, all right. And then he came up without really any lyrics at that point. He came up with a whole musical bed put together. The song, like the song you heard, he put together that music and the vocal melody. And then it was my job to write the lyrics.
Uh-huh.
And it took, I mean, there were some moments, there was a few lines that I couldn't get right at first, and he kept pushing me to say, no, you can't, nope, you got, that's not it, you gotta try again. And I'm glad he pushed me, and I did write like the whole batch of lyrics on a plane, and we kept 90% of them. Like, it was one of those, but then we had to refine it. But yeah, a lot of people have, you know, reached out, a lot of people all around the country, the world, that have found the song through, I got it on a NASCAR video game soundtrack. So a lot of people found it that way. And then I just think people found it. People added it to some Spotify playlists. And so people are finding it all around the world. Excuse me. Sorry. Let me mute for a second. All right. Sorry about that.
Not a problem.
Yeah. People just really responded to it. I play it live. People love it. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
If that's, you know, my theme song for the rest of my life, that's all right.
Sure. There you go. There you go.
Yeah. I wrote it from a really honest place, and I think people heard that and connected to it. And a lot of people are, hopefully motivates them to be like, you know, my life isn't over at 30. You know, I didn't achieve all these things I wanted to do by 30 or 40 or 50 or 60.
Sure. Like,
people can still, you know, there's so much life. Well, you got to do it. You got to do the work, but you know, you can still do it later in life.
When I taught at the university, one of the things that I would always do in advising incoming freshmen was kind of settle them down to the idea that you don't have to have your whole life figured out at age 18.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times I would have students that would come in to see me, and they would be distraught because they hadn't decided on a major. they hadn't figured out what they wanted to do, where they wanted to go. And I said, well, look, part of the process of coming to the university is to try things. I mean, so I, you know, it's like, so your major is deciding and your minor is self-discovery, because you don't know at age 18 what you are, you know, eventually going to bloom into.
Yeah.
To borrow a phrase. And, you know, I mean, yeah, there's some people that, you know, knew when they were 12 years old exactly what they wanted to do and what they were going to do. And that's what they put their minds to and they worked at it and so forth. But I don't think that's most people. And I also think, too, that, like, you're absolutely right. I don't think there is a deadline or a timeline for accomplishing things. The only thing that puts an end to it's when you're put in the grave.
Right.
Because I don't care how old you are. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. And yep. And you just go on and you try new things and you try, you know, don't limit yourself. And I think that's, you know, thank God that we can still bloom even later in life, let alone wither and die, you know, which is what I think happens with some people.
Totally.
The other song, another song that really intrigued me was the very last song on the album, October. I don't know. It spoke to me, you know, as a relationship song. It seems like as the story of the song goes along, both partners in a relationship are working through their feelings for one another. And in the refrain, it seems like the doubts are expressed of it working, because you use the phrase to be or not to be.
Yeah. And hopefully Shakespeare doesn't come after me.
I don't think he will. I think his royalties are, he's all caught up, and I don't think you have to worry about that. But I liked that, because I went, oh yeah, he's borrowing a little bit of Shakespeare here, and that's wonderful. Shakespeare, you know, Shakespeare was one of the largest contributors to the development of the English language. I read a book, I can't remember how many new words he coined that then became part of English vernacular. I've got a book I read called The Biography of English. Or, yeah, uh-huh. English, The Biography of a Language. That was what it was called. It's a really great book.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, no, there's nothing wrong with quoting Shakespeare. But I am concerned. What I'm interested in is about the song October, and really, what is at the center of what you're expressing here?
Yeah, it's a relationship song. I can definitely confirm that.
Okay.
just a relationship. I mean, I tried to really write that as poetry. As flowy and poignant and ethereal as possible, and flowery, did I already say that, as I possibly could. Mm-hmm. It's from the, you know, a relationship from the past. But I just wanted some kind of a vibe like that. And Tom really matched the music with the words. Mm-hmm. Jeez. And you know, I had in my head, like, this could be, I would love, you know, as real as it was, I wanted the song, I kind of fictionalized some things and I made it a little more dramatic, cinematic if possible, because I really do want, you know, like I said, I've got more than one song signed, and that's another song that got signed. And I'm trying to shift from being just a bang around singer songwriter to be like a guy that you hear his music on movies and TV shows. Mm-hmm. and while still being true to myself as an artist, always sure. Number one. So I really wanted that to be like a song you would hear on a Hallmark movie
sure.
Or a major motion picture, to be uh-huh. honest with you.
Uh-huh.
And, but yeah, you've nailed it. I mean, It's about a relationship for sure.
All right.
That's about as far as I'll go with that.
Okay. That's fine.
With you, but it came from a real place, you know, and then sure. It turned into something a little more fictional, I suppose, or uh-huh. or it straddled the line like a lot of my songs do, honestly.
Sure. Okay. Well, we'll look for it. I think about another, there's a singer-songwriter from Twin Cities I interviewed. Oh, my goodness. Might have been a year ago. And anyway, one of his songs got used by the commercials for Minnesota Tourism. So, you know, that was really, really kind of cool the way his, he said lots of people got to hear his music and kind of a way to find out that it was him that wrote it. But anyway, well, the last song I want to talk about is the opener, and it's Vertical City. And I love Vertical City. It's a great opening tune for an album. I mean, it's a real kicking rock tune.
Yeah, thank you.
And I kind of sensed a very strong melodic relationship to American Idiot by Green Day. It's the delivery of the opening lines that you sing, and also the addition of that kind of country honky tonk piano. And with a great contrast, you know, that you come up with in the chorus. What I'd like to have you talk about is to my audience is about the song, its musical structure, and was American Idiot a basis of any inspiration for you?
Well, that song started, I think we wrote that in the height of lockdown.
Okay.
I'm fairly certain we wrote that in like May or June 2020. And I was trying to, with the lyrics, I was trying to really capture the mood of the country and the mood of my own, you know, headspace. Saw this footage of New York and all around the world, really, where the streets were bare, you know, and, it's just crazy to witness that. But I did, and I tried to put it into song form, but with, you know, Tom again came through with the music, and a lot of times we would say, you know, let's make this like X, you know, let's jumping off point, you know, this has got to be but we lean more towards like a Black Crowes type song than I would say like the Green Day suggestion that you made, although maybe subconsciously that was there too.
I know when I was listening to it, and after I listened to it, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 times, and I got thinking, this reminds me of something, and I kept just going through my musical memory, and the first thing that kicked in was American Idiot. Things can be very similar and by happenstance but nonetheless, I mean, it's sort of like there are some other great ideas just from a purely musical standpoint that the song contains that your production team put in there. And I thought, was really, I mean, like I say, it's just a nice way to kick off an album. It just did.
Yeah, I agree.
It's got a rock and sock'em kind of sound to it. I really like that sound.
I agree. Thank you.
Yeah. I assume that you're writing new material. You say you write every day. So are you're currently writing new songs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And
I have no plans right now to release anything anytime soon, aside from that Eagles cover that I'm going to do.
Okay. All right.
That'll be out hopefully later this year. I'm not going to put any more original material out this year. I don't plan to. I mean, I want to let this album breathe and let it be out in the world for a while, since it took us 2.5 years to get to this point.
Yeah, that's. I think that's understandable.
Actually, 3 years almost. You know.
Sure, and you want it to develop some legs and live a life too. So, well, that's good.
Yeah, I don't know if I could top it. To be honest, I'm a little scared of trying to top this album.
Well, I've often, you know, a lot of times I've in discussions I've had with people about, you know, how a band will come out with a really great debut album, and the sophomore album is always kind of like, not quite what I was expecting, you know,
yeah.
Maybe not quite up. And maybe that has to do with a lot of things other than, say, quality of work or effort. I mean, I think it's always terrible that, you know, we always tend to compare artists with what they're doing now versus what they've done before. And we also, I'm talking about as a music consumer.
Yeah.
I think we always make those comparisons, which is not fair.
Right.
Because a recording is merely, you know, taking a particular set of work and sort of, you know, preserving it in the amber of time, if you will, or on the vinyl of time, or the right, or the digital information of time. I mean, that's just how you did those particular songs on a given day, and they went onto a particular recording. That does not necessarily mean that that's you all the time.
Right. These were songs that were very much a moment in time.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not. They still live on, and I think some of those songs could be timeless in a way, without tooting my horn too much. But we captured a moment in time in a time capsule, literally. And now, I'm not the same. I mean, I'm not the same person I was when I wrote those songs 2 years ago. You know,
exactly.
Those songs are still going to be played for many years by me and by other people that have the albums and the records and whatever. But yeah, I'll have new things to write about for sure. I already do.
Yeah. So. Well, I remember, and I would share this when I taught history of rock and roll at the university. I would share with my students when I would teach them about Neil Young, who's, you know, arguably one of the greatest songwriters. He and, you know, up there with Bob Dylan and, you know, great songwriter. But how Neil Young once was sued by Geffen Records, his label, because he put out a record that they thought did not sound like him. Now, isn't that bizarre?
Yeah.
You know, because the suits had a particular concept of the product that they wanted that would represent what Neil Young was, instead of he was putting out what he, you know, and the record label suiting. But I thought that was kind of funny. But I think music consumers sometimes are kind of funny that way too, in that, you know, even how a song contrasts from how it was done in the studio versus how it's done live.
Right.
You know, like, that doesn't sound at all like, you know, whatever, you know, and I think sometimes people, you know, because what we consume is the last take, the last edit of everything, whether it's movies, TV, music, we rarely does the consumer see all that goes into the production of those kinds of things, or fully understand, you know, all the various angles that go into creation of a work of art. I don't know if you have seen this. There's a documentary out about the Beatles, their last session before they broke up. It's on, I can't remember right now what streaming service it's on. It's maybe on Apple TV. I've watched maybe one episode of it. But here's what fascinated me, was how the four of them worked in creating, you know, songs. Like McCartney would start strumming his guitar and he would get an idea, like he would start singing Get Back, right? And then John Lennon would kind of look at him and kind of get an idea, and he would add something. And then, you know, George Harrison would add some kind of other guitar accompaniment, and then Ringo would add the drum patterns, the drum beats, and so forth. And then they had a guy off to the side who was sort of like a scribe, who would write down the lyric ideas as they would say them. And then there was a cut, they would cut to a scene where they'd go back and review, and then say, oh no, let's change that word to, you know, this and that and the other. So in other words, you've got to kind of vicariously experience that creative process of how the Beatles worked and how, you know, and like, of course, they were in a different environment. Here you're talking about, you know, not even being in the same room with the guy writing the music for your lyrics and how you're able to work that way. You know, of course, the technology that we have. So it's, I don't know. I'm always kind of fascinated by that. I know for myself, I usually get my best ideas when I'm in the shower. And unfortunately, I don't have a waterproof pen, so I don't write them down. I have to try to remember them until I get out.
All right.
Anyway, so Brett, kind of as we're getting to the tail end of things here, share with us what have been some of your more memorable experiences, musical experiences.
Working on an album with Mark Bryan from Hootie and the Blowfish. I've mentioned them a few times, obviously, and sure. They were the biggest band in my life for so many years. And then I reached out to Mark almost 10 years ago now. It was 2013 when I first went solo, and I reached out to him to produce my what I wanted to do. I wanted to make an album, and I reached out and he said, yeah, let's do it. So
wonderful.
I got to work with Mark. He's the lead guitar player for Hootie, co-founder. He actually played on the new album. He played a mandolin track on that song Deja Vu,
mm-hmm.
which was really nice of him to do. But that was a huge thing for me to work with Mark, and he really helped teach me about songwriting and writing hooks. And, you know, they won 2 Grammys for a reason, you know. Sure. They wrote good songs, and they still do. So that was a big milestone for me. And then when I did the Bon Jovi cruise in 2019, I got selected out of, I don't know, hundreds of people that submitted to perform on this 4-day cruise with John Bon Jovi. And somehow I got picked to do that. And that was a really cool experience. I met a lot of cool people. And on a lot of tequila. and then now with, you know, this album, it was a process. It was hard. There was a lot of hurdles, but the end result can't be disputed. I don't care if people can say they don't like the music or the style, but you can't dispute that the songs aren't good and the production isn't good. And we poured out every ounce of ourselves into this album, and we're proud of it beyond compare. So it's been a hell of a 10-year run there. But those are the top 3 things, you know, working with Mark, the cruise, and then working with Tom on this album. And yeah, here we go. Let's see what's next.
That's great. I mean, hopefully there's going to be other things that are going to be memorable for you as well as we go along. Well, Brett, the last question I have to ask you is there anything else you would like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
Not really. I mean, anything they want to know about me, for the most part, they can find at my website, brettwiscons.com. They can buy, you know, merchandise or my books. I've got my 5th book coming out later this summer, early fall. Mm-hmm. So I've got pre-orders going for that early August. And that's about it, really. I'm just creating.
Good just for you.
Hopefully people want to come along for the ride, because I'm going to be driving anyway. So
yeah, that's a good way to put it. You know, it's either lead, follow, or get out of the way.
Exactly.
Yeah, and pardon my dust. Well, yeah. That's awesome, Brett. Well, listen, thank you for taking time to talk with me today.
Sure.
And I certainly want to wish you all the best with what I'm sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate your time and your talent.
You bet. Well, thank you.
My discovery composer of the week is Bruce Adolph. Bruce Adolph is a composer, educator, performer, and author. whose music is performed worldwide by renowned artists, including Yo-Yo Ma, Itzhak Perlman, Fabio Luisi, Joshua Bell, Daniel Hope, Sylvia McNair, Carlo Grante, the Washington National Opera, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, Jeff Kahane and the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, the Zurich Philharmonia, the Iris Orchestra, the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, the Beaux-Arts Trio, the Chicago Chamber Musicians, the Brentano String Quartet, the Miami Quartet, the Cassatt Quartet, the Corrente Ensemble of Belgium, members of the Silk Road Ensemble, and over 60 symphony orchestras. Some career highlights include Itzhak Perlman's world premiere performance of Adolf's solo violin work, The Bitter, Sour, Salt, Sweet, at the Kennedy Center and Avery Fisher Hall. Yo-Yo Ma playing the world premiere of Self Comes to Mind, a work based on a text written for the project by neuroscientist Antonio Damasio at the American Museum of Natural History. Violinist Daniel Hope performing the violin concerto I Will Not Remain Silent with the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Jeffrey Kahane in 2017, and with the Essen Philharmonie, conducted by Jamie Martin in 2018. Joshua Bell performing world premiere of Einstein's Light with pianist Marija Strok at UNESCO in Paris as the finale of the United Nations Year of Light, 2015. The Washington National Opera performance of Let Freedom Sing, The Story of Marian Anderson, libretto by Carol Levia Heron. An evening of Adolf works at the Kennedy Center. Two full-length operas on Jewish subjects at the 92nd Street Y, and nine world premieres at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. The 2019-2020 concert season featured eight premieres of works by Mr. Adolf. Additionally, he contributed the chapter on composition to the book, Secrets of Creativity, What Neuroscience, the Arts, and Our Minds Reveal, a collection of new essays by neuroscientists and artists, published in 2019 by Oxford University Press, edited by Suzanne Nalbantian and Paul Matthews. Other recent concerts include Adolf's Thuampa Puen Ji, Four Harmonious Friends, based on a Buddhist story, was premiered at the Off the Hook Arts Festival in Colorado, performed by members of the Silk Road Ensemble, Mike Block, Shane Shanahan, and Kaoru Watanabe, and bass trombonist Steve Wilson of the University of Texas, El Paso, with Bruce Adolf narrating and playing piano. Over the past 25 years, Mr. Adolf has served as composer in residence at many festivals and institutions throughout the United States, for which he has also created and led educational concerts and workshops for all ages and levels of musical accomplishment. A key figure at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center since 1992, Mr. Adolf is the founder and director of the Society's Meet the Music Family Concert Series, and is also the Society's resident lecturer. He has appeared as a commentator on Live from Lincoln Center television and as a regular lecturer at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The author of three books on music, he has taught at Yale, Juilliard, and New York University. Since 2002, he performs his Piano Puzzlers weekly on Public Radio's Performance Today, hosted by Fred Child. With Julian Pfeiffer, Mr. Adolph co-founded the Learning Maestros, a company dedicated to creating new works and related curricula that integrate music with other disciplines, including science, literature, history, and issues of social conscience. His book, The Mind's Ear, Exercises for Improving the Musical Imagination, was published in a second edition in October 2013 by Oxford University Press. Mr. Adolph's music is recorded on many labels, including Sony Classical, Bridge, Delos, Telarc, Polyrhythm, Albany, CRI, New World, and Naxos American Masters Series. Mr. Adolph was recently appointed composer in residence at the Brain and Creativity Institute in Los Angeles, where he works with neuroscientists Antonio and Hanna Damasio and Asal Habibi. He lives in New York City with his wife, the pianist Marija Stroke, their daughter Katya, and Polyrhythm, the opera singing parrot. The All Music Guide lists 12 recordings of Adolph's chamber music, one recording of his concerto for flute, oboe, string quartet, and harpsichord, four of his works for keyboard, one of his opera, Michael's The Wise, four recordings of his work for voice with accompaniment, and two miscellaneous works. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube performance of Bruce Adolph's Einstein's Harmonic Mind, performed by Emily Andrzejczyk Peterson, violin, and Bruce Adolph, piano. That wraps episode number 105. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artists' performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Coming up next week, I'll be interviewing New York City-based multi-genre saxophonist and composer Caroline Davis. We have a great conversation about her work in improvised music, including, and separate from jazz, modern classical, R&B, and folk music. Other upcoming interviews include Paducah, Kentucky-based blues singer-songwriter and leader of the band 61 South, Lou Jetton. Upstate New York folk rock singer-songwriter and leader of the band Warden and Company, Seth Warden. New York City-based jazz drummer Donald Edwards, and jazz big band composer, arranger, and leader Stephen Feifke. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog signing off from the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.